Hello, everybody, and welcome to the official LPAssociation.com Coochcast. Today we are going to be wrapping up the tour with some stories about the set list, other things related to the tour. As always, I am Derek, and I'm here with my fellow staff members Todd, Lewis, Keaton, and Luke.
Hey.
So, Luke. And, of course, the next person really does... Of course, the next person needs no introduction. He's the man, the myth, the legend, the man behind the live sound of Linkin Park shows. There's Pooch. Pooch, tell people a little bit about yourself and what you do for the band. Go ahead.
Hey, how you guys doing? I'm Pooch. That's my nickname, of course. My real name is Ken Van Druten. I am the front of house engineer for Linkin Park, which means I mix the sound that you all hear for the audience at live shows for Linkin Park. And I also do the mixing for the DSP that you guys get to hear afterwards. I think it's – I pretty much hear more Linkin Park than Linkin Park has. But I do all of the sound-related things to Linkin Park that you guys get to hear.
Sweet. Well, see, what you guys had missed before this podcast began, see, we always do a pre-podcast test where we basically, test the sound levels and, you know, get to know the person we're going to have on the podcast. And basically, we should have started this podcast about an hour ago because Pooch was telling us some awesome shit, none of which was actually recorded. I apologize. So we had told him that, you know, if the question comes up, even though he's answered it before, just to say it again, you know, and everyone's saying, damn me. Hey, no, damn me in the chat. No, damn Pooch for coming so early. I'm just kidding.
Yeah.
All right. So, basically what we're going to do, we're going to be talking about, you know, the recent North American tour. Some of Pooch's favorite live moments. Maybe might even ask him of his history with Motley Crue, because that's always a good story.
Oh, my God.
But yes. And now I'm getting smacked in the chat as well. That's funny. So basically, I'm going to start off by, even though probably everybody on the planet knows the answer to this question, I think it's a good way to start off the podcast. Tell us about how you got your nickname, Pooch.
It came from Motley Crue. Basically what happened was I was working for Motley Crue and Vince Neil of Motley Crue, the lead singer, started calling me Big Dog. And I don't know where that came from, whatever. He made that up and started calling me Big Dog, and it eventually evolved into Pooch. And then right after I started working for Motley Crue, I started working for Whitney Houston. How's that for a 180 degrees?
Yeah, but, bit of a change.
Yeah. Anyway, the nickname stuck while I was working for Whitney Houston. And then what happened was is that there were people that knew me as my real name, Ken, and knew me, and there were other people that knew me as Pooch, and they couldn't make the connection that it was the same person. So I just started going, you know what, I'll just accept it. So here it is, Pooch. And now, 20 years later, it's I fully accept it. I think the only person that doesn't call me Pooch is my wife.
I'm not going to comment on that.
Does she call you Big Dog?
I'm not going to comment on that.
Yes, just in case you guys did not know, this podcast is rated R, so. Hey, I wasn't the one who said it. That was Lewis. But anyways, yeah, I'm being chided. See, I take the abuse. Basically, whenever there's a mistake on the podcast, they always yell at me. Everyone else gets away scot-free. Lewis.
Derek, it's always your fault.
It's usually your fault.
And yes, last podcast I did make a screw up. I like to do a Tosh.0 web redemption right now. It is not Mario, it's Mario Brothers. I just thought I'd say that right now. But anyways, back on topic. Tell us about how you got your start, Pooch. How did you even get into this whole music business?
Oh, man. Jeez, that's a long story. Let's see.
That's why you have an hour and a half.
Yeah, exactly. I have always been a musician. In fact, you know, my mother always talks about how when I was even in a crib or whatever, a car seat. Yeah, when I was a puppy. And she would, my mother was a piano player, and she would put me in my crib underneath a grand piano that we had at her house. So I blame my mom for what's going on now. Basically when I was about 3 years old, I started playing classical piano, and I studied classical piano pretty intensively until I was about 12 or 13. And then when I was 12 or 13 and the hormones kicked in, I discovered that you can't get any girls by playing piano. So you gotta switch to something else. So I switched to guitar and bass. And join the rock band, right? It's the whole teenage angst thing, you know. I'm gonna get the chicks by being a guitar player. Started playing in bands around Los Angeles, and I grew up in near Los Angeles, and I decided that I was gonna kind of make this my career, I ended up going to, first off, I was a horrible teenage kid. So I was doing all kinds of crap to my parents. I was, you know, the usual shit as a kid. I was doing all kinds of drugs and whatever. And so my parents are like, "You're going to boarding school." Shit. All right.
You were a bad dog.
I was. Yes, I was a very bad dog. I'm still paying for it. You know, 40 years later, I'm saying to my parents, "I'm sorry. I was a shit kid." what ended up happening is they sent me to boarding school, but it was a performance arts boarding school, kind of similar to my, you know, the FAME kind of thing. That
were you like
really.
Glee?
Oh, sorry.
Were you a Glee kid?
Yeah, Glee kid, exactly. Oh God, kill me. It really accelerated my wanting to be a musician and wanting to work somehow in the music industry. From there I got a scholarship to Berklee College of Music and went to Berklee. And the first semester that I went there, the first part of the school is very intensive study of musical instruments. But along with that, I discovered the recording studio and discovered that, it's a place that I wanted to be. I was in bands, and one of the bands that I was in won a Battle of the Bands competition. And the prize was like a weekend in the studio. And I spent that entire weekend like not playing my instrument. I spent the weekends, watching what the recording engineer was doing and going, man, I want to do what that guy's doing. So I fell in love with that whole thing. And my first semester at Berklee, I started working at a local studio there just as a runner, just a guy that was going to get, you know, coffee and shit for the engineers. And sat there and learned. And so as I went to school for 4 years there in Boston, I was also working at a recording studio, and I eventually worked my way up to being a recording engineer there at that studio and did a couple records. My big record that I did there was a band called Criss Cross. Do you guys remember this band? Probably.
Yes.
I do.
Criss Cross was these two kids that were like 10 and 11 years old. And they wore their clothes backwards and wore their shoes backwards and shit. It was funny, entertaining. Anyway, that was my big foray into the music industry, was the recording engineer for Criss Cross. Criss Cross gonna jump, yeah. God, kill me. So, and then from there, I moved to Los Angeles, and I started as a recording engineer in Los Angeles. Did a bunch of records that I was really proud of. I did a Tony 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 record that got nominated for a Grammy. Then I ended up working for a hair band called Warrant. I don't know if you guys remember that band.
The song called Cherry Pie was their big hit. And they had fired their front of house guy, their guy that mixes their live sound. And they asked me in the studio, they're like, hey, we're playing a gig tomorrow. Would you like to be our front of house guy? And I'd never been a front of house guy before. I never even mixed a live show before, ever. And the next day, I literally was mixing a live show at the LA Forum in front of, 15,000 people. So it was trial by fire. And I fell in love with the whole instant gratification of, 20,000 people screaming for something that you're doing. And kind of have never really looked back. Linkin Park is kind of the first time that I've delved back into where I started, which was being a recording engineer, and doing all of the DSP mixing is kind of taking me back, 20 years back to when I first started. So I'm really enjoying that a lot. So long story short, that's how I ended up here.
Nice. What I did is that while you were, taking about half of the podcast up with that story, I'm just kidding.
Yeah.
We actually opened up the chat to some questions. We actually got quite a couple good ones.
Cool.
By the way, just to clarify, there's a lot of people who ask where you are at the shows. Pooch is referred to as the front of house sound engineer. If you ever look at the back of the venue and you see somebody behind a tower of gear, basically, that's Pooch.
Yeah.
So if you ever want to, stalk him after the show, that's where you can meet him. Sorry, Pooch.
Thank you for telling me that.
Fans stop by and say hi. That's cool.
So there's actually some good gear questions. I'm just going to go into order of which they're asked, and you can answer them as you see fit. Cool. First of all, somebody wants to know, what is the brand of ear monitor that the band uses during the tour?
They use a brand. God, what the hell is the guy's name? He used to be a guy that worked for Ultimate Ears, and now he has his own company. Geez, what are they called? Hold on one second. I can dig it
up. Yes, you're already stumping him.
You already stumped me, man. Jeez. no, but let's see here.
We should have just gotten Mike for the podcast. He wouldn't have.
He would have known right away, wouldn't he?
Well, hey, we want Mike for the podcast, but Mike isn't returning our calls, so I'm just kidding.
Yeah, I even went to his house and he didn't answer, and instead the police came.
Yeah. Yeah, he looked outside, he said, damn it, it's that Derek kid again, he won't go away.
So the guy's name is Jerry Harvey, and it's called JH Audio, is the guys who does the
I've always wondered myself, what do they hear in those monitors? Is it just what they're playing or Chester's vocals, or is it anything else?
Each guy gets a different thing. There is another guy. His name is Kevin McCarthy, and his nickname is Tater. He is, and that comes from not the potato, but from Dictator, by the way.
Yeah, you said sick.
He does the same thing that I do, except he is mixing for the band. So he is a mixer that's kind of behind the stage on his own console. And every guy gets their own thing in their own mix. And basically it's similar to what's happening out front, what you guys are hearing. But it is also has cues in it, like stuff like click track so that they can start a song. And also, maybe, Mike in his ears may want to hear more of himself than some of the other guys, for instance, or Rob in his ears wants to hear more drums than the other guys. And so that's, they're hearing
some vocals similar. Suck really bad. They want them turned down,
Exactly. Yes.
So they each have their own kind of mix going on. And it is a little bit different than what you hear out front for sure.
Hmm. Oh, by the way, someone asked, this is going way back to the beginning of the podcast. Somebody was kind of insulted by you dissing the piano. They want to know what's wrong with the piano.
Hey, in Two and a Half Men, Charlie Sheen's character plays the piano and gets all sorts of women.
Yeah, so what's going on with that, man?
Yeah, that's right. Well, I don't have Adonis DNA, so I don't know. If I had Adonis DNA, maybe I might be able to play piano and get the chicks. come on, classical piano, like, you know, I was really intensely studying. I was doing like state competitions of classical piano. How many chicks are you going to get playing classical piano, really?
You should have switched off.
If you're Charlie Sheen, you're always winning, so.
Winning.
Yeah, but see, if you're the guitar player, man, you're out there, you know. Look at Brad, he gets all the chicks.
Does he really? Is that a story you would like to tell us?
No, I don't know. I just think it's
Oh, man, there's so many good questions here. I'm just basically scrolling through these, trying to get some really good ones for you. What is the most time-consuming song to mix? And branching off of that, are there certain types of songs that are harder to mix than others? For example, slow songs, fast-paced songs, or, you know, synth-heavy? You know, what is the most difficult song to mix?
Oh, geez. I would say it's definitely one of the new ones. There is a lot of stuff going on in a lot of these new ones. When They Come For Me or Waiting For The End is probably pretty tough. You know, the biggest problem that I have live is trying to make the old songs work with the new songs. You know, the new songs have all of the synth stuff in it. I'm speaking about the stuff in A Thousand Suns specifically, not so much from Minutes to Midnight, but A Thousand Suns. There's a lot of like low endy synth pad things that are really, you know, they have a lot of really big sub information and that kind of stuff. And so when you go from a song like that to say Paper Cut, or one of their older songs from Hybrid Theory, it's difficult to make those two songs sound similar, where you don't have too much sub information from the song before and not enough sub information with the older songs. And so the transition between those songs is kind of the most difficult for me to do.
What happens on your end when Mike's keyboard decides to take a shit for the 1,000th time during the tour?
We fucking freak out, because it's the one thing that makes about, you know, most of the sounds for some of those songs. You know, I can't remember what show it was. I think it was San Jose, where the keyboard just took a shit, and then they brought in the backup keyboard, which then promptly died as well. I remember specifically at that show standing in front of house going, I don't know what we're going to do. I guess we're going to have to change the set list or something. Cause when the keyboard broke, there were about four or five songs coming up that had integral keyboard sounds, that we, you know, I was sitting there going, there, I don't know what we're going to do, seriously. But, luckily they got one of them to work and we went on.
Yeah, and apparently the one that did get to work was one that Mike also spilled water on. So he had to transpose the notes. I think he had to, you know, change it like change it to an A on certain songs.
That's crazy. How do you guys know this shit? Anyway,
we're all geeks and we pay attention to everything they said.
Yeah, no. So what happened was the night before San Jose, Mike had spilled an entire bottle of water into the keyboards and didn't tell anybody that he did that.
Nice. So
he didn't tell any of us techs or anybody. He didn't tell anybody. So, you know, the next day we fired stuff up and it seemed like it was working fine and whatever. But as the show went on, the keyboard started really taking a turd. So after that, I always say to Mike, I'm like, dude, if you pour water into your keyboard, you have to tell us.
And isn't it like a $7,000 keyboard?
It's a very expensive keyboard. I'm not sure exactly how much it is. I think it's upwards of $10,000, yes.
And who pays out of pocket when this gets broken? Does he replace it?
Well, I mean, you know, the band is the one that purchased all of those things. And, you know, keep in mind, too, that's an interesting thing as well. You know, we have three complete backlines of stuff, which means that we have three identical things for everything that is on that stage. And not only that, but for the keyboard specifically, there are a backup for every single keyboard. And that's supposed to work. Obviously, it didn't work in San Jose. But anyway, so if you think about that, that is six of those keyboards times 10,000. That's 60 grand worth of keyboards hanging out. I'm sure he was bummed when he poured water into a $10,000 keyboard for sure.
That's probably why you didn't tell anybody. I can just imagine him spilling it and be like, you know what? Nobody's going to know this, you know? and then you open it up to fix it, and you're like, dude, there's water damage here. What's going on? And Mike hangs his head and says, I'm sorry. What was the loudest show on the North American tour? I mean, I'm not trying to make you choose one over the other, but what do you think was like the loudest one of the tour?
Oh, you know what? I mean, when you're talking about appearance of loudness, that's
versus actual loudness.
Yeah, versus actual loudness is a different thing, because I actually I am very I pay attention a lot to sound pressure levels, and the reason being is that I definitely don't want to be the guy that causes any hearing damage to anyone. I really feel like that there are some people, especially sound men out there and bands, that are irresponsible with that and are mixing at ridiculous volumes, and some people's ears are paying for that. I don't think that you should have to come to a rock show and have to put earplugs in, or if you don't bring earplugs, have your ears damaged just because you went to a rock show.
Exactly.
So I really try to mix, what we do is we have all kinds of instruments that measure that kind of stuff. And one of the things is an instrument that measures sound pressure level. And we mix at about 102 dBA weighted using LEQ, which means it means a sample of loudness over time. So we take a sample of 10 minutes and say, the average loudness of that was 102 dBA weighted. And just so to give you an idea of what 102 is, 102 is probably like standing about, 150 feet away from a jet plane taking off. there are some people that mix 105 dBA weighted, which is like standing right next to a jet plane taking off. We are conscious of loudness levels. Now, having had that discussion, there are appearance of loudness. There are sports arenas, especially in the U.S. If you think about it, a sports arena was never designed to be a place to have a rock show in. A sports arena was designed so that when you put 20,000 people in there, it gets louder and louder and louder, because you want the whole impact of 20,000 people screaming. You want the room to just get to vibrate and to be bigger. So when you put a rock show in an environment like that, most times it just gets worse. And especially there are some places where seats are plastic and there's a lot of glass and that kind of thing. And the appearance of loudness, even though it's measured at 102, is much louder. I would say that as far as crowd is concerned, the two loudest shows were actually LA and Madison Square Garden. There were times when we measured the crowd by itself at 110 dBA weighted. So that is three times as loud as the actual show is. And granted, it's peak moments. So it's when, obviously when the crowd is at its loudest, it only happens for a good, 5 seconds or something. But 110 dBA weighted out of a crowd is fucking ridiculous. That's really loud.
I got a question. There's a lot of people, this just goes to show how much we pay attention to this shit. There's a lot of people who are asking, according to a tweet that was sent out by Chester, apparently Montreal was registered at 135 dBc weighted. Is that correct? Or
yes, that is correct. So when we're talking about C weighting and A weighting, they're two different things.
Explain that.
102 dBA, or 110 dBA weighted is somewhere around 133 dBc weighted. And C weighting and A weighting, without getting too technical into it, is A weighting does not take into account low end information where C weighting does. So yes, I probably believe that that is true. That's probably something that I told him, but I don't remember.
Somebody asked, speaking of that, this is actually an interesting question. You've been with a lot of bands, not just Linkin Park, but, you know, Limp Bizkit and Motley Crue, one of the ones you're mentioning. What is the heaviest band? Now, I know there's a difference between appearance of heavy and actual heavy. What is the heaviest band you've ever mixed live?
Pantera.
Ooh, how, what was that? What was that registering at? Do you remember what the weighting was on that, or?
I actually don't know the measured weighting, but it was fucking ridiculously loud.
That's especially Pantera, man.
Yeah, I mean, and it was a time in my career too where I was young and pretty irresponsible about mixing at loud volumes. You know, it's harder as a sound engineer to make things sound good and have impact at lower volumes, obviously. And so it's a lot easier to just turn the shit up, and have it have impact regardless of what it sounds like. Some people will think that it sounds better because it's just louder. And I was at a point in my career where I was young and I was mixing stupidly, ridiculously, irresponsibly.
So, you know, I know somebody who's in their 40s who remembers the time they went to a Pantera show and walked out deaf. And
yeah, great. And now they're going to sue me. Thanks.
Yeah, now they'll be listening in. They'll be like, oh, so that's the asshole who did that.
Yes. Great.
And I can't believe somebody in the chat doesn't know who Pantera is.
Yes, what? You must listen to Pantera immediately.
Oh, my goodness. So, like, born after 87 maybe or something.
Anyway. Yeah, I think that person, not to embarrass you, but I think he is about 14. So, yeah.
Well, you should check them out because they were a band that has a lot of influence on bands today for sure.
He's 16, so
perfect.
So
you've probably heard them before. You just didn't know it was Pantera.
Probably. I mean,
it's one of those bands where you can't really.
Come on, Cowboys from Hell, man! Check out Cowboys from Hell. Anyway.
If you want a good intro song, ABZ RAR in the chat, probably one of the most mainstream songs probably was Walk.
Yes.
So if you want a good intro song to them, that's probably the one you want to look up. Now, of course, there's a lot of better Pantera songs, like you just said, Cowboys from Hell, that weren't as mainstream, but Walk's probably the best intro song if you've never heard it before. So. And Chester also did a cover of Walk with Disturbed. Unfortunately, that was before they were really awesome and made sound, the soundboard recordings. So unfortunately, no good recordings of that does exist. But
oh, that sucks.
Yeah. I mean, you can tell them to cover it again.
Yeah. Chester does. I'm sure you guys know this, but Chester does all kinds of little side things. And I've seen him a bunch of times playing with other bands and stuff. And, Chester is an amazing guy to do other people's songs as well. You know, I've seen whole sets of him, like, pulling off other people's shit. And, anyway, you guys know he's super talented.
Yeah, like the Camp Freddy shows.
Exactly.
He needs to do a lot more of those because especially when he, like, covers the Alice in Chains stuff or
yep. –
Songs by Live, I mean, he nails them. He's awesome. And, you should also tell the band not to be afraid to do grunge on their album. I know a lot of people want to see them do grunge. And, it's like they're afraid to touch it,
Yeah.
I mean, they should do an Alice in Chains type song. I mean, not copy them, obviously, because nobody can be Alice in Chains, but
I agree.
resident Alice in Chains fan right here, Luke. Hello, Luke. Awesome.
Yeah.
I think Chester could do a really good job on Rooster. That seems kind of a song tailor-made to his vocal style.
100%. I would love to see him cover some Alice in Chains.
Yeah. Well, ooh, you know, I think that I think that's why Chester does other projects, because, you know, Linkin Park has their own thing, man, their own kind of deal. You know, they've got all these influences. You know, Mike comes from a totally different direction than Chester comes from, and it's why the band works so well together, you know. So I think for them to do, you know, whatever, a cover of an Alice in Chains song would be a great thing for Chester, but it would be a weird thing for Mike. You know what I mean?
Right.
Well, actually, speaking of the crowds and everything and the different types of music, returning back to your, you know, the questions about your mixing, somebody asked a pretty interesting question. Are there any songs that bore you to tears? Any songs that you're tired of mixing? That you look at your computer and you're thinking, "Oh fuck, not that song again."
Oh man. No, I mean, you know, all of their songs are great songs.
Good answer.
Sometimes, let's see, Shadow of the Day. Sometimes I'm kind of like, oh God, here we go. Shadow of the Day. I really, you know, I like the song and all that kind of shit, and I identify with the lyrics and all the shit's cool. But after a while, you're just like, oh God, Shadow of the Day.
Yeah, I think that was the song where when I was at the Philly show, I was on my phone posting on our forums.
I get the impression, you know, I watch people and sometimes you're like, okay, it's time to go get a beer.
It's not my favorite song.
The thing is that, you know, not trying to diss the band, but it does kind of resemble With or Without You by U2. So unless you're a U2 fan, that song is going to bore you to freaking tears.
Yeah,
that's one of
my favorite Linkin Park songs. Though.
Yeah,
oh, sorry, Luke. I know it's a common song, without you. I don't care.
There's actually one that was just asked in the chat. How much equipment, boxes, crates, and other things are actually carried through during the tour?
How many?
Yeah, that was a really badly worded question. I'm sorry. How much equipment does the band actually transport during the tour itself?
Gotcha. Yep, got it. We travel, like for this North American tour, it was 11 semi-trucks. So 11 53-foot semi-trucks full of gear. And we were traveling in 6 buses. So the band travels with 50 people, roughly, that travel from city to city and are there every day. And then in every city, we hire an additional 60 to 80 people that are local hands in order to help put up the show. So there's about 170 people that are all kind of putting the show up. And I don't know if you guys realize this, and next time you go to a show, just kind of pay attention for a minute. When you walk into an arena, when we walk in there at 8 o'clock in the morning, there is nothing in that place besides floor and seats. So all the stage that you're seeing and all the gear that you're seeing and all the stuff that's hanging from the ceiling, including sound gear and lighting gear and all that stuff, comes out of trucks and gets set up there and put up there before you guys arrive at around 6:30 or whatever. So you can imagine it's a shitload of stuff to put up.
Now, I, you know, haven't seen them overseas or anything, but the North American shows were pretty elaborate. Was all that equipment also brought over to all the international shows? I can imagine shipping all that crap to, you know, 20 different countries can't be easy or cheap.
It is neither. Kind of tone it down. Yeah, it is neither or easy or cheap. and keep in mind, like I said earlier, there are 3 different versions of this. So we actually do leapfrogging of the stuff, which means. We'll be playing a show like in London, for instance, and then the next show is in Norway, which the gear can't get there overnight. So we actually have a second set of gear that's already in Norway to meet us.
Right.
And we set that gear up in Norway, and the stuff that was in London ends up at the next show. So that's why we call it leapfrogging. It's like jumping over each other.
So not only do we have all of that gear traveling with us, but it's three sets of it moving at any given time. So, for instance, right now, the gear that was just being used for the North American tour, at the end of that, got loaded into sea containers and is going via ship to Europe to meet all of us when we go to Europe in a couple of months. And the reason we put it in sea containers is obviously to save money versus flying. So you put it in a sea container, and since we don't need it for 2 months, it, you know, they take it slow boat to Europe.
I just thought of a good question based on that. What if, especially since you guys, you know, send one of the three things over to another country or another part of Europe, I should say. What happens if you guys, say, for example, ship Mike's keyboard to Norway and that particular keyboard has water on it and doesn't work? What do you guys do then? Do you guys have ship backups too?
Yeah, no, we do, and we have to. There's been several situations, not only where one that's broken, but think about the amount of gear that's going and what happens if a couple of things get lost in the way. Luckily, to this point, because we plan ahead and because we have backups for most of the gear, it hasn't been a showstopper. But there are some things that are in amongst gear that if they don't show up, we wouldn't be able to do the show.
Apparently, there was a messed up shipment from Australia for Joe. Apparently, Joe's DJ rig, the case that was in there was filled with water. Can you tell us anything about that?
I want to know, like, do you guys have a spy? On how do you know all this crap? That's hilarious.
Well, basically, there's a lot of... See, the reason why, you know, part of the reason why we brought you onto this podcast, there's a lot of fans. See, there's just casual fans, people who listen to the music, and that's that. And then there's other people who, you know, go into the technical details, like what brand of microphones they use or what brand of keyboards they use. And right. So those people who are, you know, religiously follow that, you know, find out about these types of things. I guess.
Yeah, where do they find out about it?
I basically think that Mike's spreading these rumors around and not telling you, basically. I think Mike's posing as a fan of the crowd and being like, yo, dude, did you hear about, you know?
Yeah, no, I mean, that's absolutely a true story, dude. We showed up on, I forget what show it was, but we showed up after the Australia gig, and there were several cases that were just filled with water. I think what had happened is, the stuff had been left out in a heavy rain downpour, and stuff gets in between the seams of the cases and fills shit up. And water and electricity don't work well together, do they? So, no. Yeah, that was really screwed up. And it was lucky that we were able to kind of piece it together from backups in order to make that show happen.
Yeah, I mean, hey, water and stuff doesn't work together. I know from being a person who dropped his BlackBerry in the toilet. It
just yes, that's a perfect example. You know, electronic water do not get along.
I'm just like looking through the questions here. We have almost, well, shout out to the South American fans. I'm sure, you know, Linkin Park is probably one of the more popular bands you've toured with recently. Down in South America, Chile had 40,000 fans. Brazil had 60,000. What's it like to be behind this epic-sized crowd and see all these people? I mean, what is your impression of those humongously big crowds at these shows? I mean, does it ever, like, freak you out or...
It never freaks me out, but you know what, dude? It is the most amazing feeling in the world. You know, it's the kind of feeling you get when your hair stand up on your arms, you know, just like, wow, fuck, this is awesome, you know? People are – it's the same feeling that you guys get in the crowd, you know? It's the energy that happens there is pretty awesome. I think one of the biggest shows that I ever did was a show with Guns N' Roses, which was a Rock in Rio show. I think it was 2001 or something like that, and there were 370,000 people at that show.
Holy shit.
And so, you know, I don't know if you know Guns N' Roses, but like Paradise City started, and it's this guitar riff, you know, and it was like 300,000 people jumping up and down. Literally, the ground was shaking, like earthquake shaking.
Wow.
It was pretty fucking awesome. So, yeah, I mean, you know, we have the same reaction that you guys do when you're in the crowd with 60,000 people. I'm right there in it with you going, man, this is fucking cool, you know? It's why I do what I do.
Speaking of Rock in Rio, just want to give a shout-out real quick. There's this campaign that's going on the internet right now. I know because we probably get 1,000 tweets about it a day. The fans are really, really trying to get Linkin Park to play on Rock in Rio.
Yes.
So, I mean, I know that the promotion they're doing, if the fans have to vote to get them on there. But, you know, if you can maybe drop a line with LP's tour manager, you know, because I guess the fans really want the bands to play in Rio, even though the band's already gone to Brazil, you know. They still want them to come. They want them to come back to Brazil. So
of course, yeah. I mean, you know, there's all kinds of reasons. It's not like the band just goes, I think I want to tour in Europe today. there's all kinds of issues and logistics and all of those kind of things that are strategy that are done by the band's management team and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So, you know, I would venture to guess, and I don't want to blow anybody's bubble up, but since we were just in Rio, we're probably not going to be coming back there for a little while. Sorry.
Okay. There's a lot of really, really good. Okay, this is a good question. Seeing as you are Mr. Famous Sound Engineer Man, has anybody ever approached you after the show and asked for your autograph?
Yes. Many times, actually. And
how'd that feel?
It's a little weird. I always say, you know, listen, man, you don't really want my autograph. I'm just a cog in the wheel, you know. I am a guy that I really love what I do, and I feel lucky to be where I am, and, you know, all of those kind of things. But by no means am I any sort of celebrity. But I certainly makes me feel good that there are people that appreciate what I do.
Have you ever signed any boobs?
on the top or where the nipples are?
Any boobs?
I'd have to say yes.
All right, now that we just corrupted the whole podcast, though, Lewis had a question. Go ahead,
wait,
Lewis.
No, there's a better question. Were they female boobs?
Oh, yeah, that's right. No, they were not female.
Could have been man boobs.
yeah, that kind of sucks, right? Most of my fans are not females. Anyway.
Yeah, somebody comes up and says, dude, that show was awesome. Sign my man tits, please.
Oh, God. I don't know how I'd react to that, to be honest.
You'd be like, no way. Lewis, what was your question, man?
Oh, yeah. So the question I wanted to ask was, so of course, you're doing this now. Do you see yourself continuing to do this, you know, for, you know, pretty much for the ever, or do you think that you want to go eventually later on into something maybe a little bit different but not exactly the same? I don't know. Like, do you see yourself doing anything different later on, or are you going to stick with this general career, you think?
I will do this for as long as I can. I love what I do. I am fortunate in this life. You know, there's a lot of people, man, that go to jobs every day and they're just like, that's a fucking job. I hate it. And, you know, I go to work, I make money, and I come home and whatever. You know, I mean, I have a lot of friends I grew up with that are that way. I'm one of the very few people that is lucky enough to have a job that when I wake up every day, I go, man, I'm going to work. It's going to be awesome. You know?
So what do you do when the band isn't touring? Like right now, you know, they're not playing again until I think June. Do you just get 3 months off, or do you do something else with the band or work with a different band?
I generally work with other bands. I leave for, you know, about 10 months out of the year. I'm gone usually. For instance, this time, during this 2 month break, I'm going to work with Jane's Addiction.
Oh, cool. Didn't even know they were still touring.
They aren't. They just started. They just reformed and are doing a record. So it's all original members.
Another question. Sound restrictions in Argentina. I don't even know what that's about. could you elaborate on that?
Sure. A lot of people, you know, we had that discussion earlier about, you know, people being irresponsible and mixing at ridiculously loud volumes and causing, you know, people to lose their hearing. There is a lot of governments that have stepped in and decided that they are going to mandate how loud shows are going to be. You know, one of the hardest places in the world right now is Switzerland. Switzerland has a sound restriction that is actually, you know, not to get as super technical about this, but the problem with a governmental body getting involved with deciding about how loud rock shows should be is that what they use to base decision making on and law making about sound restriction is usually based upon people that work in factories. So we're talking about a sound that a machine makes for 8 hours straight, and it's a long, you know, when you have a machine that makes the same tone, let's say 100 dB A-weighted of tone for 8 hours straight, the damage to hearing can be very great compared to a rock show, which has fluctuations of sound where it goes from 100 dB all the way down to 90 dB, et cetera, et cetera. But the problem is that the government doesn't make distinctions between the two. And so what they base their sound restriction laws upon is a machine working for 8 hours a day. And so what happens is when we do a rock show, you end up with these ridiculous low volume things, almost to the point where, you know, you can't even hear the band because the crowd is twice as loud as what the band is. So right now, Switzerland is really hardcore. There are some places, especially in outdoor shows, is where government usually gets involved. Because you've got people that complain, you know, they have a house that's close to where the venue is and they don't want their house shaking from where they've come from me. You know what I mean? as soon as they hear a low-end thing happen in their house and their house starts rumbling, they call the cops. Yeah, I mean, it's getting worse and worse. I have mixed feelings about it. I think it's a good idea because there are people that are irresponsible. But from my end of things, there are requirements, sound requirements that are just ridiculous. It's almost impossible to have a rock show at what the government is saying that we have to have it.
We actually have a couple of aspiring sound engineers in the chat, believe it or not.
Yep.
So two kind of technical questions. One person wanted to know, and I'll ask the other one after you answer this one. One person wanted to know, do you think it is necessary to have a degree to be able to get into the sound business?
Absolutely not. I have a degree and I am glad that I went that route, purely for the sense that, it was knowledge, and it was a way to go to school and to learn things. But I would say that most sound engineers do not have a degree. And most guys come the route of being a guy that started on a tour just humping cable and then all of a sudden, you know, got an opportunity to mix a band and started getting good at that and ended up where they are. So I recommend, you know, going to college. It was a great experience for me, but you certainly do not need – it's not a job requirement. Nobody has ever asked me – no management or band has ever asked me, hey, do you have a degree in sound engineering? You know, that's never happened.
And another thing, somebody also wanted to know, if you do have the necessary experience and have gone to college for it, how do you get hired for – you know, helping set that type of stuff up for the band. How do you get your start?
I get this question all the time. How do I get your job?
how do I get your job, Pooch?
Yeah.
You know what? It is. I wake up every day and thank my higher power that I got this gig, because it truly is. You know, I mean, it's the old cliche of being in the right place at the right time, but a fair amount of this is not about talent. It's about I was lucky to be where I was. So it's a difficult question to answer, because you know, there are things that you can do to place yourself to be in the right place at the right time. But ultimately, it's really like kind of winning the lottery. So, you know, in the end, I went to the fucking local mini mart and I bought a ticket and I won. You know, I mean, that's really kind of how I feel about it. The things that you can do to place yourself to be in the right place at the right time are start working, specifically if you want to be a sound person, is start working at your local venue, you know, arena or an outdoor, you know, amphitheater or whatever, as a local crew guy. If you remember, we were talking about how we hire an additional 60 to 80 people. Those are people that are hired by the local venue. And are guys that get to have all kinds of opportunities to interact with us touring guys. And in several situations, I've seen people that were once just a local guy but now are on tour because they met the right people. So that's one way to get there. Another way, specifically for sound guys, is to start working for a sound vendor. There are, you know, I would say about 10 to 20 national touring vendors in the U.S. that all do national act tours. Some of them are Clare Brothers, Sound Image, Eighth Day Sound, Audio Analyst. These are all companies that provide sound gear to touring people. And if you can get a job working for them, that's kind of the accelerated rate of how to do this. I didn't come from that way, although there are a lot of people that have. But I didn't come from the traditional way of you know, being a guy that's on a tour, just putting up PA and then eventually getting an opportunity to mix. I was lucky enough to already be a mixer and get a mixing job right away. So I feel very lucky in that sense.
Somebody has an echo. I can hear myself. A Sieg from that question. This one actually comes from the pops, from the dad. He wanted to know, I know you said Motley Crue, but what was the absolute first bands that you've ever mixed for live? Was it Motley Crue or was it a different band?
No, it was Warrant was the very first band that I ever mixed for.
Okay.
Yeah.
And another person wanted to know two comedic questions here. One person wanted to ask if you like bacon.
Are you kidding? Bacon makes it better, man. Put bacon on anything.
And you know what? I told myself I wasn't going to answer this question, but fuck it. Somebody wants to know when's the last time you showered.
How is that relevant?
I don't know.
Actually, this morning. That's a weird question.
Was it a good shower? Was it a good shower? What you said?
It was an excellent shower. Thank you for asking.
You should. I mean, if you were actually reading this chat, Pooch, we were getting some of the weirdest questions. You're getting marriage proposals.
I'm already married.
I told him that.
Hey, hands off. The big dog is fine.
It could be. We could have like some sister wives or something. A little big dog.
Okay. Here's an interesting one. Somebody, I guess you must have worked with System of a Down in the past.
I did.
Somebody wants to know what it was like to work with them, and will you be working with them in their upcoming tour? Probably not, because you're joined with the band. But
no, damn it, I'm pissed that I'm not. Actually, I got the call to work with them again. They're awesome, man. Those guys are great. Yeah, unfortunately, I'm committed to Linkin Park, and so I will not be able to do the upcoming System of a Down reunion. But yeah, no, they're awesome. I mean, they are, you know, when we talk about Linkin Park are pretty down to earth, you know, great guys. System of a Down is great guys, but they're also crazy in their own right. I mean, Darren, the guitar player, fucking really sweetheart of a guy. But man, is he's crazy too, man. He's does some crazy shit.
I'm just like reading the questions here. Some of these. Okay. Well, what's your favorite country you've gone to with the band? I mean, what was the one that you thought was the best and most beautiful?
God. That's a hard question. I've been lucky enough with this band to go to some really, a lot of places that I hadn't been to with other bands. You know, mainland China, was really interesting to me. Also, recently we were in Tel Aviv, which was a trip, you know. How many times do you get to go from Abu Dhabi to Tel Aviv? I mean, you know, that was pretty cool. I don't know. The most interesting place, I don't know. I mean, they all have their own really cool things. What's really awesome to me now as I get older is that I've been to a lot of these places many times, and I kind of have my own places that I've loved to visit, and now getting to go back to that same place. You know, I know the same restaurant or the same whatever. Going back to those places is a lot of fun.
How involved were you with making the DSPs free? Was that something that, you know, you were involved with at all, or was that basically mostly the band's decision?
Absolutely the band's decision. I don't have anything to do with the business side of it. The band came to me 4 years ago, whatever it was, and discussed about how they wanted to start doing DSP things. We talked about how we wanted to make it basically a record quality bootleg, and how we were going to go about that, the technical side of it. But I have nothing to do with the whole business side of it, selling it or any of that kind of stuff.
No, as far as I know, Linkin Park is the only band I could think of that actually does the DSPs. Are there other bands that I don't know of, or are they really, truly the only ones to do it?
Linkin Park is the only band that does. They're different in the sense that there are other bands out there. I can think of a few, Pearl Jam and Slash and some other bands that actually release the front of house mix after the show. What they do is release something like literally 15 minutes after the show, you can buy a CD of the show that you were just at, which is pretty cool. But what happens is you end up with a recording that is kind of just not all that great. And hopefully if I'm doing my job, the DSP is something like I described earlier, which is a record quality bootleg. We're trying to make something sound good enough to where you're going to want to listen to it a bunch of times. The things that stuff that like Pearl Jam is doing, releasing a front of house mix, which is just a left and right of the actual front of house console mix. You know, it might be something that you want to identify with and be like, oh yeah, I was at this show, but it's not something that you're going to want to listen to over and over and over.
Right. So the front of house mix is what people hear at the show, right?
Correct. But the problem with that is, without getting too technically into it, is that there are so many factors that are involved with a front of house mix. You would have to make the vocals louder in order for it to be heard in some rooms that sound like crap or whatever. What ends up happening is the actual recording of that mix ends up being unbalanced. So there's, you know, really loud vocals and quiet guitars and drums that are kind of halfway there. And in the live setting, that works. But when you listen to it as a recording, it doesn't.
Yeah. Well, I mean, on behalf of the fans, you asked, you know, hopefully you're doing your job right. I mean, I've listened to a couple of the DSPs. I'm sure a lot of people can agree that the quality of these DSPs from this tour are very, very good.
Well, thank you.
You're very welcome. I just thought I'd, you know, stroke your ego a little bit there, make you feel better. You know? But yeah, I mean, I do think they sound really good. I mean, the Philly show sounded exactly how I remembered it. So, cool. But another question. This is just so you can say something funny, basically. Somebody wanted to know, what was the funniest mistake or funniest moment that you can remember recently with the band? Like, are there any funny stories you would like to tell us, basically?
I don't know about funny, but it, you know, Chester, every once in a while, Chester goes somewhere. I don't know where he goes. He's on stage. He ends up going, his brain goes somewhere and he forgets the lyrics of his own songs. But what I think is hilarious is that, you know, a lot of bands would have ego about that and be like, you know, motor through the song and make no comment about it or whatever. But Chester is awesome, dude. After a song that he forgets the lyrics from, 9 times out of 10, he'll be like, fuck, man, I forgot the lyrics. Sorry.
And then he doesn't have you go back and fix it in the DSP. They'll release it as is.
They don't try to hide it. We walk this fine line of trying to keep it the most live that we can and an accurate representation of what happened at that show. You know, there are some things where, you know, sometimes where, for instance, Mike or Brad play a wrong guitar chord. Now, I don't know about you, but if I'm listening to a recording that's happening over and over and over again, and I'm listening to something, you know, I got it in my car and I'm playing it every day on my way to work, I'm not necessarily going to want to have that stupid one guitar chord out of, you know, that's wrong happen every day. So those small little details like that is what we do fix on the DSP. You know, it was something that happened in the live show, and it may be something that you don't really recognize when you're there at the show. But as soon as you start to hear things, you know, up close and personal, and especially, you know, cranking in your headphones or whatever, those are the type of things that I think should be fixed. But the overall scope of the accurate representation of what happened at that show, I desperately try to hold on to the feeling and how you were at that show. So if Chester forgets the lyrics for a verse, we don't, you know, there's nothing we can do to fix that. It's like that's what happened at that show. So
Were you in the show from – somebody made an interesting story in the chat. Were you at the Montreal show a couple years ago where Joe apparently lit a fire on stage? Apparently he set something on fire and a crew member had to come over and stomp it out. Were you with them when it happened or
– I don't know that story, but it doesn't surprise me from Joe. Joe is a little mischievous guy, man. He's always doing stuff like that, you know. So yeah, that doesn't surprise me, but I don't specifically know the show that you're speaking of.
Yeah, apparently he took the scarf off his Nino toy, lit it on fire, and then it burned up a lot worse than he thought it was, so him and a crew member had to stomp it out.
That's awesome. Yeah, it doesn't surprise me. You gotta keep in mind, remember that I am far and separated from the band. I'm not on stage. I'm in the back of the arena. So things that happen during the show, I a lot of times I don't see or even hear about.
Oh, and what do you think, as the band talked about what they're going to do to, for example, there's a lot of shows that for a while they were using Wisdom, Justice, and Love. And on a lot of the DSPs now, the band has had to cut it out because Martin Luther King's estate did not want that reproduced on a live recording. And yes, it might have been played during the show, but on the actual, you know, recording itself, I guess there was legalities about that. Is the band going to eventually drop that song, you know, completely, or?
I don't think so. I think that they it's a part of the new record. I think that they want to make the show have, you know, some portions of the record that you can remember about. And I actually really like that part of the show, Wisdom, Justice, and Love, during the live show. And it bums me out that because of licensing stuff, we can't release it on the DSP. But I don't think that they're going to stop playing it because of it. I just think that it won't be a part of the DSP ever.
I'm kind of trying to look here. A lot of people probably pretty much asked a lot of the questions people were asking. I guess while we're waiting for people to ask more questions. I don't know. Okay, somebody asked a question. I don't know. I've never heard of this before, but I'll ask it anyways. Do you know anything about the band wanting to play A Thousand Suns only at selected shows? I mean, have you heard anything about that? I've never heard of that myself.
No, I don't think that that's a true statement. I think that they want to always have a mix of their new stuff and their old stuff wherever they go. I don't think you will ever see a show from Linkin Park that doesn't have a sampling of one of their records. You know what I mean?
Oh, okay. Somebody was asking. Okay, I get it now. Do you know of any plans to play A Thousand Suns all the way through, like from start to finish? One of those special shows.
No, I don't. It's interesting that you say that because my first impressions of A Thousand Suns was that it is a single piece of work.
Yes.
And that in a lot of ways it's, you know, it's like whatever Pink Floyd, Dark Side of the Moon, which is a record that's intended to be played from top to bottom. So that would be really cool if they did, but I don't know that they have any plans in the future for that.
Kind of on the same token, Robot Boy is, somebody just asked it. I think Robot Boy is the only song from A Thousand Suns they haven't played live. Do you know why that is, or if they have any plans to play it live on their upcoming European tour?
I don't know why, and I don't know the answer to that question. I do know that they haven't been rehearsing it or any of that kind of stuff, so I would say that it would take some rehearsals of that song in order for them to play it live. However, we are doing a rehearsal period prior to the European tour for a few days, so I guess just wait and see.
Will you guys be doing the DSP things for the European tour as well? I mean, is this something you guys plan to continue throughout
I think the DSP thing will be a thing that happens at every single show, except where it's not possible to release a DSP because of licensing issues. For example, there was a period there in Australia a few years ago where we couldn't release some Australian shows due to some licensing issues. But I think that they have kind of worked that out everywhere around the world. So I would anticipate that you will see a DSP from every show from now on.
Okay, here's an interesting question. I mean, I guess nobody ever really asked this, but when Chester was sick and had to cancel some shows, I mean, I know you tour around with the band, you follow him around. I mean, what did you guys do when Chester was sick? Did you just stay in the same city and just twiddle your thumbs for a couple days? I mean,
yeah, man. I got to tell you, it was 9 days of, we equated it to being like a ship lost at sea. You know, I mean, it was like we drove to Washington, D.C., and then we drove we'd never drove to Connecticut because we knew in Washington, D.C. that Connecticut was going to be canceled. But we did drive to Chicago or to wherever the hell the name is. What's the next city?
I want to say it was Cincinnati, I think.
Yeah, Cincinnati. We drove to Cincinnati, and then we drove to Houston, and then we drove to Dallas. And in all of those places, you know, I mean, basically we just got a hotel room and, you know, did whatever that day. But, it was 9 days of basically us having 9 days off. But a lot of that is driving in a bus, you know. Some of those drives were really long drives.
Well, you actually already told us this story before the podcast, but you know, you had some pretty good details about what happened to Chester during that time. Would you mind repeating it to the people who obviously weren't listening before the podcast?
Sure. So. Yeah, of course. I mean, you know, I don't know the inner details of it, and you'd have to ask him. But basically, from my understanding is that he originally got the flu, and it was a really bad flu. And went to the doctor in order to see what was going on. And they actually started doing some tests on him that were really, hardcore tests. In fact, I don't know this for a fact, but I'm pretty sure that he had a spinal tap done because they thought at one point that he had swine flu and they thought that he had, meningitis or something. anyway, and some of the tests that they did actually made it worse. So, you know, the original flu, he probably would have been out for only a couple of shows, but because of the testing and the stuff that they were doing, it made it worse. So there you go. Sometimes going to the doctor doesn't make it better.
The questions are coming in a little bit slower. I guess everybody's getting answered what they thought answered. So we'll probably go on for about... Sorry, go ahead.
Oh, yeah, I just saw a good question. I was kind of wondering this, too. Do you get to do any sightseeing when you're going to all these cities, or is it you kind of get there, do your thing, and leave?
It depends.
I'd imagine going around the world, you'd want to see stuff.
Yeah, for sure. If we have a day off, that is not a travel day, which means we don't ride in a bus all day long, then those are days that definitely all of us get out and see stuff. And luckily we have those, you know, especially when we're doing travel outside of the U.S., there are more days like that where we, you know, fly in the morning from somewhere into a city and then spend the entire day. You know, I can remember a while ago we were playing in Greece. And we flew in the morning the day before the show, and we spent the whole day like walking around the Acropolis and all kinds of stuff. So it's really, really cool. And that's part of the opportunity of working in a live show, which is great, you know.
Yeah, this is kind of a on-the-spot question. Probably might want to watch how you word this, but somebody asked, if you were not involved with Linkin Park, would you be a fan of their music?
I would say yes. I would say that prior to me working for them, I would not have been. I honestly, I didn't really know anything about Linkin Park and wasn't hip to, as I am now, like, I don't know anything about Justin Bieber.
Would you ever sound mix for Justin Bieber?
Oh, God, yeah.
I don't know if there's really any sound mixing. I think he just played a record and then he lip syncs to it.
There's no talent going on there. Like, so.
Oh,
that's all no, auto-tune.
I really, you know, it's not like that Linkin Park, I was a fan of Linkin Park prior to working for them. Now that I have worked for them, there are definitely songs and lyrics and particularly some songs that I totally identify with. Breaking the Habit, really identify with that song greatly. I am a fan.
Somebody asks, because you've done, oh my God, what kind of question is this? Had you seen the movie Speed prior to your current job? And if so, did it color your perceptions of traveling on a bus?
I like it a lot. Yeah, I mean the image of Keanu Reeves driving me around makes me fucking kind of crazy.
But no way!
Oh, nice. That was good.
Perfect.
No way. Yeah, no. Although, I mean, you know, I will tell you, in my career, I have been in a bus accident, and that was no fun.
Was there a bomb on the bus?
What's that?
Was there a bomb on the bus?
There was no bomb on the bus, but there was a road in Wyoming that had a straightaway for about 3 miles, and the bus driver fell asleep. And at the end of that 3 miles was a hard right-hand turn that he obviously didn't make because he was asleep. And we drove off an embankment and down the side. And, you know, so I still there's nights sometimes when I'm sleeping in a bus going, you know, this guy's got our lives in his hands. I hope he's awake.
Yes, Pooch does have a Dutch name. He is part Dutch and part Irish. Is that right?
Yeah, I am. I was adopted, so I am actually full-blooded Irish, but my adopted family is Dutch.
Hmm. Somebody said you're a Viking.
It's very possible. I don't know a lot about my real history of my real family, but yeah.
You were raised on a Viking ship and left at sea. A Viking with a kilt, yes. Now this is going to be really tough. I actually think this is probably going to be the toughest question you answered. You've been mixing their DSPs probably for close to maybe 2 years now. What is your favorite? Do you have a favorite one that you were like particularly proud of that you just sat back, listened to it, and thought, man, this is the shit? Or do you kind of like them all about the same?
Interesting. There are shows that I think are better than others, for sure. From a technical aspect, from my end of things. And a lot of it has to do with, you know, how the room sounds and whatever. But, what I thought was really cool was a few years ago, they released a bulk of songs that were, like, fan favorites. Mm-hmm. All of those choices... I went through all of the choices that the fans chose, and I was like, oh, yeah, right. That was fucking awesome, you know? So they were right on with all of those choices. There's some shows that are better than others. I thought on this run, and particularly just recently, like I said, there was some great ones. You know, Madison Square Garden was great. Staples Center in Los Angeles was awesome. The Philly show was really good. You know what I mean? There's all kinds of ones that are good.
Okay, here's an interesting one. I know you've mixed for a lot of bands in your history. Have you ever mixed for a band that was not from the United States? Like a Canadian band or maybe a band from Europe or anything like that?
Oh, God. I worked for Courtney Love for a while, and she's from Mars. No, she's crazy. But now I can't think of one band that wasn't an American band. I mixed a band when I was doing records. I mixed a band from Brazil called, I forget what they are, Araya Karaoke, I think was the name of their band. I'm probably not pronouncing it right. But they were really cool. They were a band that had, you know, all kinds of really cool instruments. And, and they sang in Brazilian or Portuguese. I was really stoked to work on that record. But other than that, not really.
I'm sorry to start laughing. Dean asked another interesting question that I just have to ask. Does your bus smell funny and have scary people sitting at the back of it like normal ones?
Yes. Actually, it does. All right. So think about it. There's 12 roadies that work 16 hours a day. How do you think that bus smells?
And there's also probably a bathroom on the bus, right?
There is. Yeah, you can't. The rules on a bus are no paper in the toilet, no shitting on the bus, but you can pee on the bus for sure.
Number one only?
Number one only.
That sounds like a good idea.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, that's a classic rule that's passed down from generations. No number twos on the bus.
No number twos on the bus. It is a classic thing. Although, you can bag it. And this is for emergencies only. Emergencies only, you place a garbage bag in the toilet that you normally pee in. You shit in the bag and throw the bag out the window.
So that means that if I'm ever driving alongside a bus, it could be you guys and I should move out of the way?
Tossing a bag of poo out the window, yes.
Well, I have a question.
Don't drive in your bus.
When that happens, I know it happens rarely, but do you guys ever have target practice and see if you can hit a car?
No, I can't say that I have ever tried that. Well, at least not that I remember and was sober and doing it. But...
Okay. I doubt it, but, you know, it's one question that's been asked a lot. Have you ever got the chance to meet Mark Wakefield, which was the original singer of the band before Linkin Park?
I have, actually.
Oh, I have. What was that like?
Cool. I mean, you know, the guy was a really nice guy. It wasn't in a setting of – I wasn't introduced to him like, hey, this was our original singer. I was introduced to him like
You know, the, hey, this is Mark, and he does some stuff with the band on the side and does this or whatever. So I didn't really know who he was when I was introduced to him. Later on, someone told me, hey, by the way, that was the original singer. And I was like, oh, that's cool. You know, but yeah, that was as far as it got.
Here's an interesting thing. How does the band, not sure if you know this because you're not that closely involved with them, but how does the band come up with the idea to, you know, for example, you know, sing A Place for My Head over Bleed It Out, or, you know, come up with the idea to do these clever things? I mean, do you have any stories of how that came together? Do you know if they're going to plan to do something like that for the European tour, or?
I would imagine that they do. They do that quite a bit, obviously, as you know. I am not privy to any of those conversations. The band totally does that on their own. I know it comes from all of them, from Brad and Mike, from Chester. I know they all, you know, say, hey, wouldn't it be cool if we played this over the top of that or whatever? You know, and I've been in situations like in rehearsals where they have experimented trying to come up with something new. But the original idea, I'm not privy to, like, where it came from or who decided to do it.
And you can actually mention, like, the code name for it, like A1 or C5 or anything like that. But out of all the set lists that the band went around with during the tour, do you have, like, a personal favorite? You can name a show, too, if you don't remember what the actual set list name is.
Yeah, I think C6 is kind of my favorite. I think any of the set lists that end with One Step Closer, that's my favorite song to end with. I think C6 was, we played the very last show in wherever the hell we were, Houston. Yeah.
I can confirm that. We actually have the set list typed up here. While I'm looking that up, though, and I forgot what my freaking question was. See, that always happens. Oh, somebody says you should become an avid poster on the OBA. Somebody said you should join the site. I agree wholeheartedly Thank with that. okay, in Houston, they ended with Bleed It Out. It wasn't One Step Closer.
Okay.
Might have been Dallas, I think.
Probably yeah, maybe Dallas. I think you're right.
Okay, by the way, what was it like finally returning to your hometown after all that time?
Good. I mean, I love playing in Dallas. The American Airlines Center there is one of a great sounding arena, so it makes my job a lot easier. And then on top of it, you know, my whole family and stuff were down there for the day. I even have my dog there. my dog was locked up in a dressing room while we were doing the show, and I came back from the show, and the dog was just sitting there, like, shaking, like, going, what is all that low end?
I hope he didn't make a deuce in the room. That might have not been
said. She may have, and, you know, I don't know. I'm sure I'll hear that from the band.
Yeah, all of a sudden, the people are cleaning up after the show, and all of a sudden, they get a bill for cleaning fees, and under the description, it says dog shit in dressing room.
What is all this dog poop everywhere?
Yeah. what kind of dog do you have? Somebody asked that.
I have a boxer.
Boxer too. Love
you do, yeah. We rescued her about a year ago. She's 3 years old. She's awesome.
Oh, is she a brindle, a fawn, or?
She's a brindle, yeah.
Yeah, I have a boxer that, if you ever hear something that sounds not human, someone going like, that's my, boxer trying to get through the door. I have my door shut so that way my boxer doesn't, you know,
yeah,
knock over my microphone or something like that. So, yeah, if you ever hear someone that sounds like not like human breathing, that is my boxer. Yeah, so.
I could vouch for that. Derek's boxer is very hyper.
Derek, yeah, you know, over and the dog.
Derek's dog, Derek's boxer kicked me in the nuts too.
That's right, because the boxers, what basically happens is that they jump up and try
to box. That's what they do.
Box.
Yeah.
So, Todd, you know, kind of expected it, but Todd was, you know, we were getting ready to go down to Philadelphia, and he was downstairs. He was looking up, talking to me, and all of a sudden, my dog came in like ninja style and just kicked him right in the nuts. And I see Todd just like keel over, going, and he's like, "Your dog kicked me in the nuts."
That's great. I love it.
A question I saw posted a few times: how long does it take to mix a DSP?
24 total hours of work per show.
Wow.
Okay, I'd be surprised if you would know this answer. Dean always likes to ask the weird questions. What weight class is your boxer?
What is Dean smoking? Because I want some.
He's British. That's his excuse.
Gotcha. Okay. My boxer is a 55 pound. I guess that makes her a featherweight, doesn't it?
Somebody wants to know if your dog watches you while you sleep.
Yes. Boxers do that. Have you ever woken up and have your dog just staring at you?
Yeah, all the time. I wake up and I'm looking at the dog and the dog's just like looking at me and I'm like, what?
What?
And all of a sudden it bats its paw and that means it needs to be fed. I'm like, I just woke up. I'll give you food in 5 minutes.
My boxer doesn't make a noise. So she doesn't whine or she doesn't bark or any of that kind of shit. But when she has to go potty, she'll just stare at you. She just sits there and stares at you. And so that's
my boxer actually talks to me. It actually makes like weird growling noises when it needs them. Huh. Yeah. Okay. Somebody wanted me to ask about Brad's headphones. What's the story behind that?
Brad has really super sensitive hearing. Very good sensitive. He has excellent hearing and therefore is very sensitive and doesn't want to lose his hearing. And so actually what he's wearing are customized gun muffs. So like the same kind of muffs that people wear when they go to shooting ranges. And underneath those gun muffs, he actually has earplugs in as well. So it is purely to protect his hearing.
Do you know that you just basically gave the answer to a 10-year-long mystery?
Really?
Yeah, every time that Brad has been asked about why he wears his earmuffs, he gives different answers. One, it was because he was an alien, and it was to protect him from transmissions to Mars. Another one was because he has, I think it's because he has elf ears underneath and he wants to hide them. And so you actually are probably the... Yes, yeah, so finally, you give a real answer. Oh, yeah, the other one was to plug him into the Matrix, basically. So you're the first one to actually give a real answer that he has super sensitive hearing and has to wear them to protect his ears.
Yeah, and I think it's important that people hear that, actually. You know, I mean, because kids these days are screwing up their hearing by wearing iPods at loud volumes and that kind of shit. And it's actually someone that you may idolize, such as Brad, is somebody that really thinks about protecting his hearing. So that's cool.
Just trying to look here for more questions. And yes, people, I know that there's some questions that I'm asking a full 20 minutes after you ask them. I'm asking them in the order they were received. So
that's because I'm fucking verbose. All I do is sit here and fucking chat and chat and chat. But
yeah, seriously, there was like an hour-long podcast before the podcast. Yeah. You know, Pooch is definitely a long-winded person. But we're probably going to wrap this up in probably about maybe 5 to 10 minutes, only because the questions are starting to come a little bit slower. But certainly I'll ask the ones that you guys answer during that time, but you know, probably in about 5 to 10 minutes, we're probably going to wrap it up. Okay. Here's a good question. I'm going to reword this a little bit. If you could choose one band to work with, both dead or alive, what band would you choose to work with if you weren't working with Linkin Park?
If I wasn't working with Linkin Park, who'd I want to work with?
And this could be a band that's broken up, you know, due to band members passing away or anything like that. It can be any band.
Led Zeppelin? I don't know. Britney Spears?
Would you really work for Britney Spears?
You know what? I'm a prostitute. I'll work for anyone that pays me right.
And we are so going to take that clip from the MP3 and so spread that out of context. Soon the internet's going to have a rumor that Pooch is a whore that does things for money. So,
no, I've got a question. You know, you worked with Motley Crue. I'm sure that was insane. What's like your craziest Motley Crue story that you could share with us?
And go uncensored. We want the full details.
Yeah. Oh, my God. I can neither confirm nor deny. You know what, man? I mean, it was a time of debauchery. The front of our bus had a 15-gallon fish tank. So, you know, like a fish tank, a normal-sized 15-gallon fish tank that was at the front of the bus entirely filled with condoms. So you kind of get the idea of what that's all about, right?
Oh, my God.
And, you know, I mean, you know, it was it, – it just – if you weren't getting fucked up, then you weren't, you know, they'd fire you for not getting fucked up, basically. So yeah, it was, you know, I mean, without getting into total specifics, it was an interesting time.
Did you have to sign a non-disclosure agreement not to mention some of the stuff you saw?
You know what? That wasn't happening during that time, but nowadays a lot of bands are having to sign a non-disclosure agreement.
You can probably write a book about your times with Motley Crue.
Yeah, when I'm ready to, like, you know, lose all my money and get sued by every band that I've worked for, then...
Somebody went to say Pooch, but they called you Pool instead, so for now on, you're referred to as Pool.
Predictive text sucks.
I don't know if I want to ask this one question. It's kind of creepy. Okay, hopefully he means this not in a creepy way and he's generally just curious, otherwise that would freak me out. Somebody wants to know if you have any tattoos. They wanted me to ask where they are, but I'm not. Oh no, what they are. Okay, that makes a lot that makes it a lot different. You know, asking where somebody has tattoos is kind of creepy.
That is weird. Yeah, I have a lot of tattoos. My arms, I have sleeve tattoos. All my whole arms are done. It goes into a full back piece, so my entire back is done. And I have a tattoo on my left leg that is a kind of a goblin kind of a thing. So, yeah, I have a lot of tattoos. And they all have different meaning. I mean, you know, like I have kanji on my arm, which is Chinese writing that is like my name. And there's some other kanji that says my wife's name and she's my soulmate. And then there's, you know, skull work and, you know, they all have different meanings.
It's actually an interesting question. Probably not, because as far as I understand, when you're touring with the band takes a jet and you take a bus. But somebody wants to know if there was ever a moment when you're just chilling with the band, if you ever, like, heard any of the post-A Thousand Suns music that they're working on. You know, because I know, like, the band likes to carry some stuff on their laptops. Have you heard any of the new stuff, or are you not allowed to tell about that if you have, or?
No, I mean, I don't know if I could comment it if I had, but no, I have not. I have not heard any of the new stuff.
All right. Somebody says you need to write a tell-all book when you're done. That was 5 minutes ago. You're kind of late.
Yeah.
No, I'm pretty sure Pooch has not ever spied on their laptops. That would be kind of creepy.
Yeah, that's creepy.
But aside from that, Pooch, as always, it is legendary to speak to you. You're pretty freaking hilarious.
Well, thanks, guys. You know, I just wanted to say at the end here that thanks to all the fans for coming out to the shows and being so supportive of a band that I work for. It translates exactly into my livelihood. So it's the way that I make money and the way that I feed my family. And so I'm very appreciative of you guys, you know, being out there and supporting the band that you love.
And we appreciate it as well. I mean, I know you've been kind of busy. You know, mixing the DSPs and everything. So we do appreciate you taking time out of your busy schedule to have this podcast. Of course, I agree with everybody. You know, I definitely should join on LBA and start posting. But
I don't have time for that shit.
He's like, I don't have time for that shit. Don't you guys realize what I do for a living?
I post on Facebook and that takes up half my day. Christ sakes.
Oh, and by the way, just so you can get thousands of new friends on Facebook, you don't mind me giving a shout out to where you are on Facebook, do you?
No, not at all. Big Dog on Tour. Go ahead and
That's facebook.com/Big Dog on Tour. Is that right?
That is correct.
All right, yeah. So everybody look for Big Dog on Tour on Facebook. That's how you can get in touch with Pooch. there's a lot of stuff that he says on his Facebook that we didn't even get a chance to go over during this podcast. So he has a lot of interesting stuff he has to say. He usually always answers questions. That's basically how we set up this podcast. Wrote him. He said he was down for it, and that was that. I just want to thank you again for coming out, and we'll keep you guys posted if we do any more of these in the future. But with that, I think it's time we go off air. So thanks for joining us, guys.